This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Psychology Today. This broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. This is Tracy, and today we're going to read an article under the category Gaslighting. This is an article written by Susan Krause Whitborn. The title of the article is How Gaslighters Con Their Partners into Believing Them. There's a method to the madness when gaslighters rewrite the narrative. Key points. Gaslighting occurs when another person tries to convince you that your memory has failed. A new study puts close relationship partners into situations that test the tendency to believe misinformation. Knowing how fallible memory can be is the first step to counteracting the manipulative ways of the gaslighter. No one's memory is perfect, a fact that some people take advantage of when exploiting or trying to control their partners. Nikki felt pretty certain that she correctly remembered a rather sensitive and potentially inappropriate question her boyfriend Pete asked her on their first date. The topic concerned Nikki's previous relationship partner. The question made her feel uncomfortable, but she was willing to give her boyfriend a pass. Now, 6 weeks later, he completely denies having asked the question. This could boil down to a simple misunderstanding if it were not for the fact that Pete seemed to cause Nikki to question her memory on a pretty regular basis. Now, she rarely trusts her own version of past events, but relies almost completely on Pete's reconstruction of their past interactions. Indeed, these reconstructions usually favor Pete, making him look like a generally good guy, if not a saint. Research on memory has established quite solidly the fact that recall of the past is subject to a variety of distortions. Apart from simple forgetting, people tend to shave off unpleasant features of past experiences to make themselves look better. It's also remarkably easy to confuse who said what and when in social situations. Gaslighting occurs when the memory slip isn't just some innocent moment of forgetfulness. People who gaslight do this deliberately, knowing full well that the version of events they'd have you believe is not the version of events that truly happened. According to University of Sydney's Lillian Dark and colleagues, in 2025, people tend to believe memories that fit in with some larger version of their own reality, and this makes them susceptible to gaslighting. Individuals are consistently engaging with their surroundings to validate their own memories, they note, meaning that if you may fill in some memory lapses with what you believe you'd be most likely to do in a given situation. You may think you turned off the light before you left your home, because you always do. This memory would be false if, in fact, you left the light on. In gaslighting, another person creates a false version of reality that you might believe because it seems to fit in with a larger version of the truth. Pete takes advantage of Nikki's faith in him as a good guy who would never put her on the spot. Testing the false memory theory of gaslighting. In an innovative experimental study, Dark and others put close romantic partners into a memory conformity paradigm, in which one partner challenged the memory of the other. The experiment took place over four sessions. In the first session, Participants selected joint memories without telling each other the details. In the week between sessions 1 and 2, the experimenter randomly selected one partner to provide and the other to receive misinformation. For example, the memory could include details of a dinner the couple had together. In the misinformation session, the gaslighting partner purposely read out the wrong details and, per experimenter instructions, insisted that these details were correct. After this, both participants completed the memory questionnaire again. The experimental question was whether the misinformation would change the gaslit partner's memory. Participants also rated their confidence in their recall. Overall, the manipulation worked. Slightly over one quarter changed their own recall of events to match that of their partners. Even if they didn't adopt the partner's descriptions, they expressed open uncertainty about their own recall. Going beyond misinformation, the Australian study also showed that it's possible for a trusted person to undermine an individual's belief in their own memory accuracy. Because the misinformation manipulation was just a one-off and not a repeated experience, it wasn't possible to determine whether partners who constantly are gaslighted become worn down and hopeless, as is shown in real-life gaslighting situations. Counteracting the gaslighter. According to gaslighting's effect in the Dark and Others study was, according to the authors, the elements of relationship trust and social conformity. Gaslighters operate within close relationships by inserting themselves in the space between certainty and uncertainty in the mind of the gaslit partner. People in close relationships have, note the authors, the motivation to align memories due to the social costs of disagreement. Nikki didn't want to jeopardize her relationship with Pete, so she went along with this explanation. Returning to the idea of social context, the University of Sydney study shows how a close relationship can become the context for inserting false memories. What's more, the closer the relationship, the more likely it is that being fed misinformation will create more and more doubt in the gaslit partner. Why should you believe your own fallible memory when the person you love is telling you otherwise? It should be noted that gaslighting is increasingly being understood as an aspect of interpersonal violence and coercive relationships. The authors caution that because memory can be so fallible and manipulated, individuals who may be vulnerable to this form of emotional abuse can gain from understanding just how easy it is, from a cognitive standpoint, to change someone's recollection of the past. To sum up, gaslighting takes advantage of several known fallibilities in ordinary memory, especially the tendency to rely on context and the word of someone you trust. Self-efficacy, the belief in your own memory and trust in yourself, can be two powerful tools to counter gaslighting's powerful pull. This next article is about procrastination. It's from Art Markman. It's titled, Can Procrastinators Change? New research explores age-related changes in the tendency to procrastinate. Key points. Procrastination reflects people's avoidance of hard tasks, despite negative consequences of that avoidance. There are individual differences in the tendency to procrastinate. New research suggests that this tendency decreases from young adulthood onward. Entering the workforce affects people's tendency to procrastinate. Procrastination is a behavior in which someone delays doing something they know is important. They recognize that the delay may make the outcome more difficult to achieve. Delaying a doctor visit when you have medical concerns can lead to more serious illness. Waiting to start an assignment in school may make it harder to get a good grade. Everyone has procrastinated on something important to them, but there are individual differences in procrastination. Some people do it rarely, while others do it often. Research suggests that procrastination is related to two of the big five personality characteristics, conscientiousness and neuroticism. Conscientiousness is a tendency to finish what was started. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the more conscientious people are, the less likely they are to procrastinate. Neuroticism reflects the amount of energy people have in their motivational systems and is often associated with worry and anxiety. People high in neuroticism are more likely to procrastinate than people low in neuroticism, perhaps because they fear negative outcomes from important actions. Personality characteristics are slow to change over time. If procrastination relates to two significant traits, perhaps it is also slow to change. A 2026 paper by Lisa Balke, Brent Roberts, Benjamin Nagengast, and Ulrich Treitwang in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology addressed this question by examining changes in people's reported procrastination over almost two decades. They analyzed a data set of surveys completed by young German adults who were given the first round of the survey in their final year of high school. They were surveyed periodically over the next 18 years. This survey asked questions about a variety of personality characteristics. It asked about procrastination behaviors and also about life events like getting a job, getting married, and having children. Consistent with previous work, the authors found individual differences in people's tendency to procrastinate. People high in conscientiousness tend to procrastinate less than people low in conscientiousness. People high in neuroticism tend to procrastinate more than people low in neuroticism. Interestingly, there was a general tendency for people to procrastinate less as they got older. Even though there were small tendencies for people to get more conscientious and less neurotic as they aged, the decreases in tendency to procrastinate were larger than would be predicted from changes in conscientiousness and neuroticism alone. There was also a fascinating relationship between the tendency to procrastinate and the transition from school to the workforce. On the one hand, the more someone tends to procrastinate, the later they tend to enter the workforce. The reasons for this difference are not clear. There are many possibilities for this finding. For example, it could be that people who procrastinate do worse in school, which makes it harder for them to get a job. Or it could be that the tendency to procrastinate also affects people's job applications. On the other hand, when people do enter the workforce, it has a big influence on their tendency to procrastinate. Perhaps because school is more forgiving of procrastination than work, the tendency to procrastinate decreases significantly after people enter the workforce. Finally, the tendency to procrastinate was related to several life outcomes. The more people procrastinated, the less likely they were to be in a stable relationship. They had lower life satisfaction overall, and they were less likely to have completed a university degree or to get promoted at work. Procrastination is clearly a behavior with negative effects on the lives of chronic procrastinators. However, as people age, they take on more responsibilities, and the tendency to procrastinate decreases. This work suggests that holding young adults more accountable for getting work done is helpful. To make an intervention like this more effective, it would also be useful to teach young adults strategies to overcome procrastination. This involves both teaching them how to schedule their work and how to handle the anxiety associated with assignments and other tasks. This will help them complete the work rather than avoid it. In particular, schools don't focus enough on the role that assignments play in learning skills. Instead, schools often focus students on the importance of getting good grades and minimizing the number of mistakes they make. That can build up the anxiety around big projects. If students focus more on the value of assignments for learning knowledge and skills, they might treat feedback as something that helps them learn rather than a negative reflection about themselves. This next article is titled The 7 Power Moves for 2026. It's a new year and a time for new ideas to help you thrive, from a session at camp or a return to hobbies to following new paths to better sex, more productive days, and the changes you've always wanted to make. Psychology Today has pulled together 7 proven, smallish tweaks that could deliver big payoffs this year. By Psychology Today contributors. The first one, Dabble, Especially in What You Used to Love, by Alice Boyce. Most self-improvement advice focuses on building consistent habits. That activities we do only occasionally can also deliver huge value for our mental health. In other words, it's good for you to dabble, to engage in activities without expecting steady improvement. It diversifies your sources of positive emotions, keeps your identity flexible and varied, creates social connections, and expands the types of problems you solve and the strategies you must use to overcome them. Dabbling can and should challenge you, but it can also remind you who you are. Karaoke reminds you that you're playful, knitting that you're creative, theater that you're sophisticated, volunteering that you're generous, and trivia that you're competitive. These positive emotions are especially valuable during transitions, waiting periods like college admission season or trying to conceive, and low energy times like winter. Typically, dabbling involves returning to an activity from time to time as the urge or opportunity presents itself. To keep diverse activities in your wheelhouse, you can link them to an annual occurrence, like volunteering at a charity event every summer or making jam when berries are in season. Or you can involve a young family member, like taking a niece ice skating when she comes to visit each holiday season. An activity can also be a backup plan, something you do when you can't do something else, like knitting when your internet is out. I suggest keeping a list titled Activities I Forget I Like and adding to it when you do new things you enjoy so they don't disappear from your mind. Keep basic supplies on hand like sketch pads or a yoga mat. Psychological benefits don't come only from getting better at the things you do all the time. If you don't improve at something you do only occasionally, that may not matter. It can still boost your positive emotions and remind you of a forgotten but valued aspect of yourself. Alice Boyce, PhD, is the author of Stress-Free Productivity. Number 2 on the list, Don't Complain About Sex, Just Ask for What You Want, by Nicole McNichols, PhD. Most of us know that good sex thrives on communication. But the reality is that not every conversation about sex brings us closer. Some boost intimacy, while others unintentionally create distance. A recent study published in the Journal of Sex Research sheds light on which types of communication invite connection, improve sex, and bring couples closer together. The key finding is that sharing turn-ons strengthens intimacy and satisfaction, while bringing up turn-offs can backfire. In other words, not all sexual self-disclosure is created equal. In the study, participants who reported sharing what they wanted more of, what they liked, or fantasies they wanted to explore, instead of raising sexual dislikes, reported higher sexual satisfaction and greater relationship happiness overall than those who didn't. For women, sharing personal likes with partners was especially effective. they experienced fewer sexual difficulties linked to sexual pain or the inability to reach orgasm. Focusing sexual communication on one's dislikes, on the other hand, was associated with lower intimacy and relationship satisfaction. This may be because dislikes can easily be heard as criticism, which often generates defensiveness and a sense of distance. Of course, there are times when it's necessary to speak up about what you don't like in bed, such as when sex causes pain or violates your personal boundaries. Those crucial moments are about maintaining consent, trust, and safety. So how do you put this into practice? First, choose the right moment. Deeper conversations about new things you'd like to try, for example, tend to go better outside the bedroom when you're not as vulnerable. When you do talk, open-ended questions are most likely to spark the connection. What's something you'd like more of? What's something you've always wanted to try? Or what drives you crazy that you want more of? And if you do feel the need to express a dislike, framing makes a big difference in how it will be received. I like it better when you ... lands much more softly than I hate when you ... Handled well, these conversations shouldn't kill the mood. Quite the opposite. They should build trust, deepen intimacy, and keep passion alive. Nicole McNichols, PhD, is a professor of human sexuality at the University of Washington and the author of You Could Be Having Better Sex. Number three on the list, Change Your Personality with Three Small Hacks by Kevin Bennett, PhD. We often treat personality as if it's carved in stone, but it's actually more like clay, shaped by experience, environment, and even choice. Research confirms that who you are today doesn't have to be who you are tomorrow. With intention and effort, you can change aspects of your personality in lasting ways. While traditional approaches to self-improvement focus on therapy or major life shifts, there are also some unconventional and surprisingly simple ways to start transforming your personality. Number one, talk about yourself to yourself in the here and now. Saying, "I'm trying to be more patient," sends one type of message to your brain, but saying, "I am a patient person," delivers quite another. It may feel awkward at first, but present tense affirmations have been proven to create a kind of cognitive dissonance that can nudge you toward behavior that aligns with the new identity you want to establish. This hack draws on the power of narrative identity, the story we tell about who we are. When you tell a new story in the present tense and repeat it enough, you begin to believe it. And that's the first step toward change. Number two, track trait-consistent micro-actions. You can't overhaul your personality overnight, but you can track one small behavior each day that reflects the trait you're trying to grow. Want to be more open to experience? Try new food. More agreeable? Compliment a stranger. More emotionally stable? Practice one moment of mindful breathing when stressed. In a landmark 2015 study on personality change, University of Illinois researchers found that people who set daily goals consistent with desired traits, such as being more extroverted or less neurotic, achieved real change in just a few months. Number three, borrow someone else's personality for a day. Think of someone you admire because they have a trait you'd like to develop, like your calm friend Rachel or your adventurous cousin Leo. Ask yourself, what would they do today if they were in your shoes? Better yet, act as if you are them for a few hours. Walk how they walk, speak how they speak, or respond how they'd respond. It might feel like play acting, but this behavioral mimicry can help you rehearse new patterns until they feel like your own. Kevin Bennett, PhD, is a teaching professor at Penn State University Beaver and the host of the podcast Danger, Deception, and Desire. The fourth on the list is Try Body Doubling and Get More Done by Ariella Crystal, PhD. A few years ago, a grad school classmate was starting to feel that working at home with all of its distractions, TV, laundry, a bed ripe for naps, was eating away at her productivity. She was looking for a guardrail to keep her on track. So we built one. Each morning, we joined a Zoom together, stated our goals, hit mute, and left our cameras on. After an hour, we'd unmute for a 2-minute water cooler chat and then dive back in. I couldn't see her screen, but my silent, visible presence was enough to keep her glued to her work instead of cat videos. I was extra productive during those sessions, too. This simple tactic, known in ADHD circles as body doubling, is based on two proven concepts. First, design beats willpower. Changing your environment, even just virtually, often works better than trying to summon heroic self-discipline. Second, one quirk of our psychology can fix another. We're hypersensitive to the presence of others and, of course, to what other people think of us. Body doubling turns that built-in spotlight into motivation, which we can leverage to overcome our equally human urge to procrastinate. Shouldn't we be able to power through on our own? Maybe. But in real life, we get distracted, bored, and tempted. Instead of berating ourselves about it, we can call on a tool that's been hiding in plain sight, another person's presence. How to try it? Find a buddy, friends, classmates, coworkers, anyone with work to do. Set a timer. Commit to 30 to 90 minute sprints. Break for quick chats in between. Keep cameras on and mics off. Seeing each other matters more than hearing. Share goals up front. A tiny dose of accountability goes a long way. Repeat as needed. The habit forms fast because it feels good to finish tasks. Body doubling won't complete your work for you, but it makes showing up and staying on task easier. So the next time you catch yourself hovering over the play next episode button, invite a friend to a silent Zoom. Let the human desire to save face do its work and watch your to-do list shrink. Ariella Crystal, PhD, is a visiting assistant professor at Yeshiva University and an affiliated researcher at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Number 5 on the list is Hug the Right Way by Sebastian Ocklenberg, PhD. Most, but not all, people love hugs. But hugs, even mutually welcome ones, are not always perfect. To build better embraces in the coming year, consider these recent scientific findings on what makes a hug extra special. Number 1. Hug like you mean it, and don't be afraid to apply a little pressure. A study from San Diego State University investigated what it was about hugging that most influenced the feeling of social connection with the other person, and found that it was deep, warm pressure. Light touch or neutral deep touch was less effective in fostering connection. 2. Hold on for 5 to 10 seconds. A study from the University of London showed that hugs lasting 5 to 10 seconds were more pleasurable than shorter hugs. But don't hang on much longer, as many people find that especially long hugs turn awkward at some point. In another study, which I co-authored, we found that friends on average hug for about 3 seconds, while lovers embrace for about 7. Number 3, lead with the left arm. When we hug someone, we have to decide whether to lead with the right arm or the left. The results of a 2019 study from Germany show that most people tend to reach out with the right arm first, except when they engage in more emotional hugs. Then they often shift to left-sided embraces, possibly reflecting the greater role of the right hemisphere of the brain, which controls the left side of the body, for processing emotions. Number 4, hug the right person. A 2020 study from Japan showed that whom you hug, and especially how close you are to them, significantly influences what an embrace can do for you. A hug between a baby and its parent, for example, reduced the heart rate of both, indicating relaxation. This effect was not found when a female stranger gave the baby a hug. Sebastian Ocklenberg, PhD, is a professor for research methods in psychology at MSH Medical School in Germany. Number 6 on the list. Stop boomer asking. Just go ahead and brag. By Clay Drinko, PhD. Boomer asking has nothing to do with baby boomers and everything to do with boomerangs. It's when someone asks a question and then answers it immediately after their conversation partner's answer. Essentially, they throw the question out with the intention of its coming back around so they can answer it themselves, typically so that they can brag about something. You've probably experienced boomer asking. You've very likely done it. And if you can manage it for the good of your relationships and the impression you make on others, you should try to stop. Here's an example. What are your summer plans? Not much, just staying local this year. Well, we're headed to the Amalfi Coast. Notice how the first speaker answered their own question without any prompting from the other? That's a boomer ask. In a recent study, Allison Wood Brooks of Harvard Business School and Michael Yeomans of Imperial College London identified categories of boomer asking, including ask bragging, asking a question that enables you to boast about your achievements or experiences, and ask complaining, asking about something or someone so that you can then complain about that thing or person. Their research also found that boomer asking comes off as egocentric. In fact, people who boomer ask are seen as less sincere and even less likable than those who just overtly brag. And yet it's almost universal. More than 90% of people reported experiencing it, and more than 90% admitted doing it. People often boomer ask with reasonably good intentions. They want to share something and also want to make the other person feel involved in the conversation, but the opposite tends to occur. The off-putting practice makes people think you only asked so you could answer. Instead of boomer asking, be direct. If you worry that people will judge you for bragging, remember that research says they like boomer asking even less. In conversations, after asking an initial question, ask follow-ups and be as genuinely curious as you'd want someone else to be, understanding that your chance to flex will come. It may even be welcome because you've already established your sincerity and likability. Clay Drinko, PhD, is an educator and the author of Play Your Way Sane. Number 7. Go to grown-up camp without the guilt. By Lynn Zubernus, PhD. Adult sleepaway camps are officially a trend. Touted as a way to take a break from the stresses of everyday life, try out new things, and make new friends, sessions are quickly selling out. What's behind their popularity? The benefits of indulging in something purely for fun or self-enrichment are well known. Leisure activities are associated with lower levels of depression and anxiety, and an increased sense of well-being. Leisure helps us manage stress and bolsters our self-esteem. The catch? We need to allow ourselves to indulge in leisure activities without feeling guilty about it. Normalizing play and leisure as not just for children, as adult camps do, can limit feelings of guilt and allow the full benefits of these activities to come through. How can we be so sure that adult sleepover camps could benefit us? In part, it's because of what we've learned from the experiences of those who engage in a similar activity. Fan conventions. Outsiders often assume the appeal of conventions is meeting celebrities. But that's neither the only nor the primary draw. The collective experience of meeting other fans is often more powerful. In one study, fans described fellow convention attendees as the people who get me, who understand and accept them as they are. Camps and conventions share many characteristics that facilitate finding community and belongingness. They are liminal spaces where we leave one world behind and undergo a change before returning to it. There are different norms for behavior and self-expression in such spaces, which allow people to be themselves and embrace their identities. Further, in an increasingly virtual world, interactions in physical spaces are especially meaningful. Conventions have been described as carnival spaces, drawing on Russian philosopher Mikhail Batkin's idea of a transitional play space where people are allowed to try on new ways of being. That applies to adult sleepaway camps, where there is explicit permission to take a weekend off from everyday responsibilities and just have fun, whether in beer tastings, arts and crafts, sing-alongs, or cooking classes. These spaces are temporary, but their effects can enrich the real world people return to, and the friendships made within them can be lifelong. Their current popularity suggests they provide an escape that is much needed. Lynn Zubernus, PhD, is a professor at Westchester University and the author of There'll Be Peace When You Are Done. This next article is titled The Friend Effect, 23 Surprising Ways Other People Shape You. Having friends protects you in multiple ways, from slowing cellular aging to deterring bullies to bolstering your self-esteem. Circles of enhancement. A few tight ties can deliver care and protection, while a loose perimeter of pals offers opportunity and stimulation, and you probably underestimate how much they matter. By Hara Estroff Morano. You've heard it a million times. Human beings are social creatures. But exactly what does that mean? Good friends, casual acquaintances, even strangers who stop you on the street. They are not just accessories to a fulfilling or interesting life. They are biological necessities as much as emotional ones. And like food and movement, they underwrite your ability to function well. Interacting with them puts SNAP into almost every system of the body, and those interactions shape your mood and motivation, influence your thinking and behavior, deliver well-being and health, even longevity. The whole field of research known as social genomics documents how social experiences turn genes off and on, especially those related to the immune system, and guard your DNA. Without pals, you wither in just about every detectable way. Before you read any further, take a minute to plan an upcoming meal. Corral one or two people you know to break bread with you, at home, in a restaurant, in a park, at your desk. Eating with friends, being in their physical company, and engaging in activity synchronously triggers the opioid system to release beta endorphin, which is both a natural analgesic, minimizing physical and emotional pain, and a euphoriant, taking the lid off levels of dopamine and suffusing you with a sense of well-being. In binding to a specific type of opioid receptor, beta endorphin creates literally feelings of warmth, of safety, of security, and drives the desire to be close. But it does much more. From stunting the stress response to expanding the prefrontal cortex and all the gray matter linked with the default mode network of the brain, to stimulating production of the natural killer immune cells that protect against viruses and cancer, beta endorphin zings through the nervous system, touching most functions of the body. It makes comrades willing to support you when you're down, to offer help when you need it. According to the brain opioid theory of social attachment put forth by British psychologist Robin Dunbar, beta endorphin is the sustaining substance of human societies. Dunbar, who contends that human brains have the cognitive capacity to manage only a limited number of social relationships, 150, famously known as the Dunbar number, which turns out to be remarkably close to the average number of guests attending a wedding in the U.S. over the last 10 years, now also finds that we're at our best when 5 of those relationships are close ties, a few less for introverts, a few more for extroverts. For all the sustenance they provide, close friendships are costly to create and maintain, requiring time, understanding, skills of diplomacy, and emotional energy. 5 is the number at which we can keep the quality high and feel most satisfied with life. A world beyond besties. We live not by close ties alone. Acquaintances, people we encounter repeatedly or occasionally without intention or effort, christened weak ties by pioneering Stanford sociologist Mark Granovetter, embed us in the wider world. And they do things for us that closer ties can't, as bridges or pipelines to diverse social circles. They bring us perspectives and information, and notably news of job openings, not likely to flow through the overlapping circles we regularly inhabit. Eva Meyerson Milgram, professor emerita of sociology at Stanford, sees little limit to the number of weak ties we can have, precisely because they are obligation-free and require no maintenance. Once in a while, she says, you have to show up for something. While strong ties optimize emotional comfort and similarity in thinking and behavior, weak ties promote learning and cognitive stimulation. We're exposed to unfamiliar viewpoints, increasing neuroplasticity and mental flexibility, says Meyerson Milgram. Strong ties come with expectations. Weak ties provide space to experiment, change, and grow without incurring emotional fallout or social exclusion. They promote freedom, the ability to choose one's core self rather than becoming pressured within tightly bonded pods. Weak ties can emerge from accidental encounters created by daily routines, workplaces, kids' schools, religious or civic institutions, and, in fact, the surprise amplifies the emotional impact of such an experience. Or weak ties can be found by joining groups that match our interests, whether garden clubs, book clubs, or classes of any kind. The paradox is that bridge ties feel optional, but their absence is very costly, says Meyerson Milgram. Her research shows that it's especially costly for women, and perhaps most costly for older women, who often lose a sense of identity or significance as they age. Their social world can shrink to a small bubble of family. Yet weak ties allow individuals to continually expand their reach into society. Women, she notes, are typically focused on strong ties, finding besties, Well, men know how to affiliate through loose ties. They generally have more experience relating to others based on interests. Of course, all ties have to start somewhere. It could be as simple as saying, I liked your comment. Would you like to grab a cup of coffee when this meeting is over? Or joining an organization such as the Y, which usually offers access to a big buffet of activities, martial arts, mahjong, yoga, painting, and much more. When you join such activities, says Myerson Milgram, you get to know people as part of pursuing your interests, typically a stress-free way of meeting new people, as the activity becomes the focus and you don't have to worry about initiating or leading the conversation. Weak ties are necessary and valuable in their own right. They help keep us interesting and agile throughout life. Myerson Milgram wants you to think of your social network as a subway map. If all your lines run through the same few stations, your five closest friends, you are efficient but fragile. Resilience, autonomy, and social courage come from adding new lines that reach entirely different parts of the city. And the wide open secret is that weak ties may be the fastest route to strong ones. Why social life matters. Important as it is, managing difficult emotions is just the start of how quality friendships influence well-being and longevity. After all, says evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar, for all higher primates, social life is the stepping stone to maximizing fitness. Having friends slows cellular aging by reducing inflammation. Friends buffer stress, actually lowering cortisol levels. Throughout the lifespan, friends reduce your risk of loneliness, depression, and anxiety. Friends bolster your self-esteem. Friends enhance your sense of life satisfaction. Having friends is the biggest bulwark against bullying. Having friends increases gray matter in brain regions for empathy and decision-making, areas that loneliness shrinks. Engaging with friends sharpens social intelligence, boosting your ability to read faces, understand people's intentions, and predict their behavior. Having friends enhances memory and general cognitive performance. Having friends literally slows cellular aging, preserving DNA. Friendship lowers levels of the immune signaling agent interleukin-6, a major driver of inflammation, thereby curbing a significant contributor to chronic disease and depression. Friendship is an all-purpose guard against premature death, lowering all-cause mortality. In the face of challenge, friendship lowers both heart rate and blood pressure, protecting against cardiovascular disease and stroke. Studies show that interacting with friends strengthens connectivity of the brain's default mode network in ways that help people understand each other and perceive the world similarly. In fact, activation of the DMN during social activity suggests a whole new role for the DMN, social cognition. Piercing the silence. Public space has become dead space, with people focused on their phones instead of their surroundings. It seems harder than ever to make a connection. Here are some simple ways to start. Adjust your mindset. Studies show that people, even total strangers, are more open to conversation than you think, and they enjoy it more than they thought they would. Look approachable. Smile and make eye contact. Summon a spirit of adventure to break the ice. Start small. Make a brief comment on some detail about your surroundings. You don't need to be clever. A few phrases are reliable openers, says psychologist Marissa Franco. I love your blank. Where did you get it? Paying a genuine compliment puts people in a positive frame of mind. How do you like blank? People like being asked for their opinions. Do you have any recommendations for blank? People tend to like people who like them. asking for recommendations sends a signal that you value their opinion and are curious to hear what they have to say. It was great to meet you. I'd love to stay in touch. How do you like to stay connected? One conversation doesn't make a friendship, but it's a start. Try to turn your initial interactions into something more. I've enjoyed getting to know you. Let's make plans to hang out more often. People tend to be particularly open to building a connection when some sort of foundation is already in place. Blank made me think of you. I've been meaning to reach out. How have you been? One way to gain new friendships is to activate old ones. They'll enjoy hearing from you. I'm always looking for new friends to blank. Would you be interested? Inviting someone to share an activity minimizes the risk of rejection. The exhilaration of doing something together compounds closeness. Saved by your squad. The validation that high-quality friendships supply does more than make you feel good. It makes you physically strong and emotionally sturdy. By Marissa Franco, PhD. The longest-running study on human development, now in its 88th year, in tracking the offspring of the original 724 participants, has found that the most significant predictor of happiness and longevity is having high-quality relationships. Not just having friends, but having the right kind of friends. We need quality friends. Quality friends are those who provide companionship. We like spending time with them. They support us emotionally. They are available, and we can trust them enough to share personal things. Another key feature of quality friends, they're validating. They encourage and confirm our sense of who we are. According to renowned psychologist Marsha Linehan, validation means communicating to someone that her or his responses make sense and are understandable within her or his current life context or situation. Linehan, best known for her studies of borderline personality, argues that early childhood experiences of invalidation may be at the heart of the disorder, and that more broadly, experiencing little validation as a child makes people emotionally dysregulated as adults. Corroborating studies provide additional evidence. In one, maternal emotional invalidation negatively impacts a child's emotional awareness as early as 4 years of age. We come to know our emotions and even ourselves from something, someone telling us it's all right to have them. The power of validation. In signaling safety and quieting the nervous system, validation heals us and makes us stronger. People who had to hold a bucket at arm's length were better able to keep doing it when they received validation from a research assistant. It's painful, isn't it? Rather than invalidation. I didn't feel anything like that when I did it. For the validated, the task took less of a toll on their mood. Another study found that when people were validated after sharing feelings about being excluded from a game, they reported higher self-esteem and less aggression and negative mood. Invalidation hurts us physically as well as mentally. In one study, people completed a nearly impossible math test in the lab. Afterward, they shared their feelings with an experimenter. The experimenter responded with something validating. Lots of people have said that they felt that way. Or invalidating. I'm not sure why you are stressed. Invalidated people felt worse and had a higher heart rate. They also felt less safe in the interaction and were more disengaged, showing less eye contact, frowning more, and smiling less. From outside to inside, validation includes statements such as, "It makes sense that you feel that way. I think your feelings are valid here. Your views are understandable. I get what you're saying." And when you want to express disagreement, "I get why you see it that way. Here's what I would add based on my view of the situation." When friends validate our emotions, they are showing us that we can accept our feelings. Such emotional validation dampens neural reactivity. Neuroimaging studies show that acknowledging our feelings limits activation of the amygdala, the brain's emotional processing center, the cluster of cells that signal threat and turn on the flight or fight response. In quieting the amygdala's response to negative input, recognizing feelings also activates the right ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, the brain region that regulates emotional responses and calms distress. We are in charge of ourselves. Marissa Franco, PhD, is the author of Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Thank you for joining us for a reading of Psychology Today. Our broadcast is for informational purposes only, and any suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Tracy. Thank you for listening.
And now, medical myths and facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
Is artificial intelligence rotting our brains? When people ask this, they're really asking, does relying on artificial intelligence weaken our cognitive skills? Well, the answer is nuanced. We know from history that when new tools appear, calculators, spell check, even GPS, people worry about mental atrophy. If a machine remembers, computes, or navigates for us, will we lose these abilities? Early studies suggest heavy reliance on artificial intelligence tools can reduce practice of certain skills like memory recall, arithmetic, or even critical writing. I can't tell you how many times I have asked patients for a spouse's phone number and have them not know it and have to look it up on their phones. But how useful can it be when we had to stop previously at the gas station to ask somebody for directions to a place they needed to get to? Nonetheless, psychologists talk about cognitive offloading, the tendency to outsource thinking to external aids. Artificial intelligence accelerates this because it's faster and more persuasive than older tools. Research shows people may become less likely to double-check facts when artificial intelligence provides an answer, and students may skip the struggle phase that deepens learning. That said, brains don't literally rot. They reorganize. Just as literacy shifted memory skills from oral recall to textual reasoning, artificial intelligence may shift us from memorization toward higher-level synthesis. Artificial intelligence can free up mental bandwidth. Instead of doing rote tasks, we can focus on strategy, judgment, creativity, or even empathy, the uniquely human aspects of cognition. For seniors, artificial reminders and aids may protect cognition by reducing stress and enabling independence. For professionals, it can accelerate knowledge work. The danger is passivity. If we always accept outputs without questioning, critical thinking weakens. Artificial intelligence isn't inherently rotting our brains, then. It's reshaping them. Whether that shift is healthy depends on how we use it, as a crutch that dulls reasoning or as a partner that extends it. The challenge is to remain active thinkers, asking questions, verifying sources, and engaging our own judgment, rather than letting artificial intelligence think for us.